Hello, and a warm welcome to Season 6 of Brown Don't Frown podcast. Our first episode went live back in October 2019, and since then, BDF has brought over 40 episodes featuring almost 50 guests and their stories straight to you. I hope you've been able to learn from them as much as I have. I am your host, Tanya Hardcastle. Brown Don't Frown spotlights the experiences of a diverse range of women and brings new perspectives. Season 6 is about empowerment and empathy through various lenses, such as navigating our 30s, not just reaching life goals and milestones, but also making new ones, parenthood and reproductive health, spinning plates, challenges, fears, surviving, thriving, finding purpose and intention, gratitude, balance, calm and rest. We've got some inspiring women, including fellow South Asian podcasters, an acclaimed novelist, a reproductive health campaigner and charity founder, and a co-director of a South Asian women's empowerment initiative. If any of that interests you, stick around and see what we have to offer. You might learn or discover something new. The BDF community has grown so much over the last 4.5 years. Thank you to all of you who've subscribed to the podcast and left us a review. As an independent podcaster, that means a lot to me. And if you want to stay updated on the latest news, podcast episodes and exclusives, then you can sign up to the newsletter by clicking the link in the episode notes. That's all from me for now. Enjoy Season 6. Welcome to another episode of Brown Don't Frown podcast. Today, we're joined by a fabulous guest, the co-founder of Forward Culture, Seetal Kaur. Welcome to the show, Seetal.
Thank you. Hey, so good to be here. Thank you for having me as a guest.
Yes, it's great to have you. And I'm honored that you gave up your time. We both know what it's like juggling parenthood and work and various other initiatives and side hustles, spinning all the plates. So really appreciate you being here in the hot seat, really being interviewed and speaking openly, hopefully, about your experiences. I wonder if we could start talking a bit more about the sort of evolution of Forward Culture, because you know, obviously it started off as a blog, as a bit of a platform, two brown girls, and over the years it's evolved to be, you know, a safe space. It offers mentoring opportunities and it is very heavily focused on empowering South Asian women in particular.
So, yeah.
It would be lovely to hear a bit more about the journey and how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, thank you. Like you said, we started from a Tumblr blog back in the day, Tumblr Girls. We were at uni, so it was myself and my really close friend Amina Patel. We went to UCL together and we were sat in Senate House Library one day in final year, and I don't know what happened. Maybe it was like some divine intervention, but we were just really bored and I kind of was like, why don't we start a blog? Because we were kind of posting stuff anyway separately and did some random bits of content, and we were engaging with social media and following quite a few inspirational brown creatives, brown female creatives and things. And we just sat there and mapped out this whole idea of two brown girls, a blog, and all the things we wanted it to focus on. So we kind of made this definition of a brown girl, which was, you know, politically conscious, kind of creative, and I essentially proud of South Asian culture. And also quite critical of it. We were keen to not be like, you know, you should just be like proud of being brown. It's just, you know, we actually focus on, the main focus is investigating what culture is to us, like how to find pride in our South Asian heritage, but also kind of analyze it and take those parts forward that we feel are relevant and that we agree with, and also kind of change those parts that we don't. But we just didn't find that there was any space, you know, online or offline to really talk about this. And yet every single, you know, brown woman or girl that we encountered struggled with the body image or aspects of their culture that wasn't fitting into like a Western paradigm. So they were going to school or college or university, and they were encountering these contexts and situations where they had huge like clashes with their family and ancestral kind of culture, and then they were having to navigate this totally opposite world. So then we were saying, you know, let's create a space. We created an online space, and then eventually we realized, you know, let's take it offline. There were more and more online spaces growing. There's some amazing, you know, magazines now and things. So now we were like, how can we really make a difference to like the next generation and provide support for South Asian female creatives and just create more spaces offline as well? So
yeah, that's really important.
And yeah, we started doing events, and now we've grown into a mentoring program, which has been really, really successful. We're on a kind of third iteration of that at the moment, where we're working with schools to pair their South Asian female students with older South Asian women to kind of give them career and cultural guidance. So yeah, we do the mentoring program now, and then we do events as well. So those are the two things that we do.
That sounds absolutely marvelous. Such an amazing journey you've been on over the last decade or so. And it's so nice that you met at university. So obviously you would have grown and evolved together in like finding your identity, finding yourselves. And obviously university, like I remember being at university and not having that sense of identity. And it's really taken a while, like entering, you know, post my mid-20s to really find like that level of confidence in being comfortable in my own skin. So it's nice that you've like developed in that way as well while you've been, you know, evolving the organization. It sounds like you've carved out a really lovely niche for the South Asian community, for women in particular, because there aren't many spaces available in that way, as you say, particularly for, you know, face-to-face organic sort of interaction, because you know that it's quite crowded, the online space now. And I remember coming across Forward Culture, actually. I think it was through South Asian Sisters Speak. I think you did like a collab or something. And it might have been during like one of the first lockdowns, during the pandemic, that I came across your initiative and found it really interesting and really dynamic in the sense that I don't think I've come across any other South Asian female-led spaces that focus so much on harnessing development and looking at sort of, as you say, ancestral ties, older generations, and how we navigate some of those cultural aspects and evolve them to be better suited to, you know, our generation and future generations, so that we don't you know, face oppression or certain aspects which obviously discriminate against women in particular, as we know, in various South Asian cultures. So it's just so nice to see that come through through this space.
Thank you.
And very much looking forward to being involved. I remember completing the survey that you put out.
Thank you so much for doing that. I mean, we were so happy to get over 250 responses to the survey, and thank you so much for contributing. It's just been a really critical and crucial aspect of evidencing what we do, because Armin and I are trying to make sure this kind of organization is sustainable. So we need to apply for funding, we need to gain partnerships, and the way that we can do that is to evidence and say, you know what, this is actually a really important thing. And a lot of other South Asian females get it. Like when you have that lived experience, you get it. You're like, oh my God, we needed mentors when we were younger. Like we needed guidance, 100%. We needed help, we needed support and spaces. But when you're talking to people who are not from a South Asian background,
they don't know,
you know, female, they just don't even know what's going on. They don't really see the issues that are there. So yeah, it's been a huge, huge part of us being able to evidence the impact of what we do and why it's important, so that we can kind of keep doing it essentially and keep growing the programs.
The funding streams. It's great. And I saw on your website you've got some amazing like funding partners, and hopefully you'll continue to grow, and obviously you'll be able to show through the survey that, you know, the tangible outcomes that you've been able to you know, create as a result of the initiatives that you've developed. And hopefully it will just go from strength to strength, and you'll have further iterations of surveys like this and gathering obviously this is quantitative, but you could even, you know, I don't know, have focus groups or something in the future that might be
we're trying to put together a focus group at the moment, so we're just kind of shaping that up to what it would. I don't want to kind of waste anyone's time, so we're just kind of making sure that we can gather some really good evidence and things, essentially. That's what it is. And it's just to make sure that we're always keeping our finger on the pulse and making sure we're relevant to what's happening and what the issues are, mm-hmm. and how can we deliver things according to that really have a real benefit. So yeah, we're putting together a focus group at the moment. I'm just shaping it up, so that's really exciting too. If anyone wants to get involved, just drop us a message anytime on Instagram or anything. Mm-hmm. And then we can support and try and make sure what we do kind of is shaped according to that.
Everyone's needs and
yeah,
that sounds great. And obviously, aside from this project and this baby that you have, you also have an actual child in real life. Yeah. And I know, like, I remember seeing all of your, some of your rants and some of your really honest views on, you know, motherhood, balancing that with your own identity, your own interests, and just navigating life, you know, in a purposeful and intentional way. Really, like, insightful, so helpful. And I think it's so challenging sometimes, to be honest, with struggles, because of the expectation, especially on social media, for us to be, you know, living these, you know, perfect lives, everything's, you know, hunky-dory. And it's nice that, you know, we can show that, you know, honest or genuine versions of ourselves when the time is quite challenging, so that other people can feel empowered and know that they're not alone. And, you know, generational traditions and pregnancy and motherhood is something that I've thought about quite a lot, even when I was pregnant, you know, before I had a baby. And I thought about, you know, my mum's experience, you know, my aunties, my grandma, and how, you know, their sort of expectations in pregnancy and motherhood have really changed, you know, through just a couple of generations. And part of it might be to do with the fact that, you know, they lived, like, my family from Bangladesh, so they had obviously very different, like, cultural norms to what I've experienced growing up here, and that would have shaped how they sort of, you know, raise their children.
Yeah.
But, and I wonder if we could sort of start there before we delve into, like, what it's been like for us personally as mothers, but, like, how we've learned from our, you know, ancestors, and what's been left behind, what's really withstood the test of time as well and carried through, and whether those traditions are positive, negative, you know, neither here nor there.
What are your
initial thoughts?
My initial thoughts is just complete shock. And I say that because I'm just completely astounded by how it's changed over, you know, 2-3 generations. Like, that's not a lot of time.
Yeah.
But because of, I feel like, you know, economic factors and obviously migration and things like that, and just, you know, feminism in general, and the economic opportunities that women have.
Mm-hmm.
I think class and race and gender, all these things, like you say, you know, intersectionally, they have a big impact. And just reflecting on, say, my grandparents, my grandmothers, you know, I doubt there was very few women from similar kind of, I would say they were probably classed as middle class, well, working to middle class kind of backgrounds, who were, like, working in actual, like, recognizable jobs, and had economic independence.
Oh, they did?
No, I'm saying, like, I doubt there were. Most of the women from that kind of
housewives
background. I mean, my nanny, my maternal grandmother, she ran a kind of catering business, and I think they just had to do what they had to do to survive, to be honest with you. Similarly with my own mother, they just had to get on with it. And that is literally the motto.
That's it. They had no time to stop and think.
Yeah, they just had to get on with it. And they didn't have time to reflect and be like, is this what I want? And this is existentially makes sense for me. And, like,
they were just on autopilot. They just, like, copied whatever happened with their, you know, what they saw growing up. And
and there wasn't, like, the internet. Actually, my mom did say to me, she was like, how do you feel for you guys and, like, your generation of moms? Because, like, we didn't have the internet and we just went for it. Like, we just did what we thought was right. And we didn't have all of these, you know, alternative opinions and ideas confusing us, essentially.
Confusing. Yeah, it's a double-edged sword, because obviously they probably went with their intuition, right? Whereas we might want to go with our intuition, but then we see all this content online and we're like, oh, we're doing it wrong, or what?
It's so confusing. And they just kind of did whatever their family members did or advised them to do. I don't know. But then again, I remember my nanny saying to me, because I was breastfeeding or struggling with breastfeeding, and she said, you know, in her generation at that time, apparently there was like a big push for formula feeding, and the nurses at the hospital said to her, oh, you know, it's not as good as formula, like it's not going to give them the nutrients. And she literally, because this is her personality, she was just like, have you had any kids? And the midwife was like, no, not yet. And she was like, so yeah, you don't know what you're talking about. She was just like, shut up. So
that's hilarious. It's so weird.
They were just had this kind of attitude of, I just get on with it. If they had to work, they had to work. If they, you know, but I mean, in terms of things that are kind of passed down that's useful or not useful, I think we're in a very, you know, it's because of their graft and sacrifices that generation are in a relative position of privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel completely privileged every single day. And it's kind of crushing sometimes, the guilt of like, oh my God, I just have so much privilege. I have so much freedom of choice, of thought, of, you know, finances. And I think that plays into motherhood massively. So
massively,
In that sense, when it comes to looking after your kids and raising them and then prioritizing yourself, I think that's a relatively new development. I think that's something that we can shed from previous generations. We can think about ourselves more and we can put ourselves first now. I'm saying that in that way because I feel like older generations might have wanted to, but they just didn't have a choice.
Have a choice. And also there's a bit of a taboo there as well, right? There's an expectation to be selfless, right, as a mother.
Massively. Like I still feel that pressure, but I'm trying to recognize it and say, I don't have to actually.
No, you don't.
Honestly, you know, and even from male evolution, if you're in a kind of, you know, relationship where you've got a husband and everything, like that kind of evolution is also a massive part of everything.
Mm-hmm.
So how are men stepping up? How are they able to share the childcare? How are they able to share domestic duties? Like, I know that's not just in South Asian culture from what I'm realizing.
It's universal.
And it's crazy how
it's
such
changed.
A huge shift now of like men sharing the load and women, you know, not just doing everything. So I think that's a huge shift as well. That's why I just said it's like a massive shock to me that it's just changed.
It's
so
changed so much
so
in a generation, I'd say. Especially so as you say, with father, like with dad's expectation for fathers. Because I think I saw a meme the other day. This is how I get my knowledge now, just looking at memes. And there was like this this older woman, like probably my mom's age, like in her 60s, and she saw like a millennial dad, right, maybe our age, out with the kids on their own, on his own, and she was like, oh, what an amazing dad, like you're taking the kids. And he was just like, yes, I'm a millennial dad, that's what we do. Maybe your generation didn't do that, but like that's pretty standard, right? It's not like you're not putting them up and giving them a medal, putting them on a pedestal, oh, you've done such an amazing job, pat on the back. Whereas you know, previous generation, that would be expected, like that would be expected from the mother. Like if the dad was doing it, people would be questioning the mum, like, why aren't you there for your child? Whereas the tables are, you know, massively turned now, and the expectation really, I think, is 50-50, right? Obviously it won't be 50-50 on a day-to-day basis. You know, sometimes you'll be like doing most of the sort of childcare stuff one week, depending on your like other obligations and commitments. And then another week it might be the dad doing most of it. So
You just try and even it out as much as you can, really. I remember my grandmother-in-law, bless her soul, she passed away last year, but she was amazing. She was so progressive, she was so accepting of how things had changed, but she sometimes would mention how it's, you know, just how she'd reflected on everything, and I remember her once saying, like, oh, you girls are so lucky. You know, we'd never have, like, our husbands helping out. Like, they'd never change a nappy. And, like, we'd, you know, they'd never do all of that. Like, you girls are so lucky. And she used that word, lucky. And I was like, am I lucky? Or are you just unfortunate? I didn't say it like that. But, you know, when you say it like you're lucky, it sounds like, oh, everything's fine now. Like, you should be happy and you should, like, be grateful and no problems anymore, you know. But I do feel bad, like, on a day-to-day basis of, like, oh, I have such a supportive husband and a partner and, you know, it's pretty much 50-50 for us. But yet I still find this really fucking hard. Like, why did I find this so hard?
And it's crazy hard. It's crazy hard.
Yeah, like, I have so much. I live with my in-laws. I have support. I have financial support. I have literally everything that you could want to, like, support a mum. And yet I'm still like, oh, my God, this is so intense. Like, it's can so I just intense. Get a break? Yeah. So, yeah, sometimes I feel like, why is it so hard for me? I think in the beginning, especially, like I said, when I was struggling with breastfeeding and I'd just given birth and I had, like, episiotomy and it was infected and there was this and there was that, I was just literally like, so is this what, like, thousands and millions of women go to on a day-to-day basis? Like, how many women right now also have episiotomies? And, like, are we just doing this to ourselves? Like, I just started going through a massive existential crisis of,
it makes you reflect. You're like, oh, my gosh, all these women have done this after you've had your baby. Yeah. They've all been through this and
been through this, like, butcher's house. And I'm like, so we all just went through the slaughterhouse and came out and we're like, go for it again. When you have a second, like, you're asking me to go through that again. Like, what? I don't understand. So yeah, I just had this massive, like, existential realization of, like, I just really struggled with the fact that everything I struggled with, the response was 99%. That's normal. And when someone said to me, like, that's normal, it just means, like, deal with it.
It means deal with it. And the thing is, what that does is it invalidates your feelings, right? Or you're feeling a certain something and someone's just saying, yeah, this is the norm, like, deal with it. Like, we're not going to do anything about it. This is how healthcare professionals really respond to stuff like this.
And
just give them birth and they're like, off you go. Like, no support.
Yeah, your episiotomy is infected. That's very common.
That's very common.
Like, that's you're the answer. In a lot of pain. Like, that's very common. That's very normal. It's just like, what is this? Like, so yeah, that's one of the main things I struggled with, you know, even with the sleep, that was just literally the pits. That was total hell for me because I realized that I have a very, very strong relationship with sleep. And yeah, it was just like, yeah, she's waking up, that's normal, baby's wake up.
Yeah.
I was just like, so there's no solution.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that's clearly universal is, you know, that no one can prepare you for having a baby. Like, literally no one. People tell you about it. And I spoke to loads of people because I really wanted to go in with my eyes open. So I wanted to hear about all, like, the horror stories, everything, just so that I could mentally prepare myself for what was to come. Because I know other people are just like, don't tell me, I don't want to know. Like, I'll just deal with it. But I really wanted to, like, know everything. I was just very curious. Yeah. And it just came through clearly that, you know, no one can prepare you for it. And then after you had the baby and you speak to people who, you know, obviously more experienced, they've been at it for longer and they say, okay, so now you know what it's like, because people do tell you, but you just don't believe them, right? Before I had a baby, I don't feel like I had any empathy with mothers, to be perfectly honest. I don't think I did. And I looked at some of them and I thought, well, it can't be that hard. Like, why are they complaining? Genuinely, that's how I felt. That's how ignorant I was.
Yeah, you're just completely on the other side of the bubble. Like, it's just, there's no way you can really fully understand.
No way.
But yet now, literally, when I see any other mum out there, I just want to, like, salute her, because I'm just like, wow, like, I kind of get what you're going
especially single parents of multiple children. Shit, I'm just like, how the hell are you doing this?
Yeah,
I saw someone at the park the other day. I was just with my son, obviously, and I was finding it hard to, like, chase around. Like, he was running around, and there was a woman, and she had a newborn in her, like, she was breastfeeding, sat on a bench. And then I was like, oh, like, do you have any others? And I just assumed, like, this, she only had one child and she was just getting some fresh air. But then she pointed to her other two kids who were, like, on the playground. And I was just like, so you've just come here to the park here on your own with three kids?
It's actually crazy. Yeah. I know. But the thing is, I realized as well, I had this like massive epiphany, I think, when Ruhi, my daughter, was, you know, in her first year. And I went over to someone's house, and one of my friends, her mum, you know, is a single mum. She, yeah, her daughter, my friend grew up with her as a single mum. Mm. And similarly myself, like my mum was a single mum. And I just talked to her, and through our discussion, I just realized that there were so many South Asian mothers of previous generations that were in marriages but were literally single mothers.
Mm, yeah.
You know, they were married, but they were single moms.
Yeah, and carrying that mental load, physical load, everything.
Just everything. Yeah, they did everything. So they might as well have been single mothers. Obviously, the economic side and financial support from the husbands and whatever was there. So that's obviously a massive difference. Like, mm-hmm. actual single mothers don't have that.
Yeah.
But generally, you know, in terms of all of the caretaking and,
yes.
and everything, they might as well have been single mothers, you know. So that's what I realized. I was like, there's so many women, especially in South Asian cultures, that are single mums, but they are in marriages where they have financial support. But yeah, they do everything, literally
that's
everything.
That's such a good point, actually. I never thought of it that way. But now when I think about my mum, like, my mum actually passed away when I was quite young. But I just remember, like, how she used to do basically everything. Yeah, like, my dad worked and he provided, but not that much. Like, she, you know, before she had kids, like, she, back in Bangladesh, she had... You know, she was a lawyer, she was an advocate, and she really wanted to continue practicing, like, when she came to this country, and she just never got her chance to do it because, you know, my dad came here and he was just like, I'm going to be, you know, the one with a high-flying career. Like, you'll get, you, why don't you just continue with the mothering, basically, and do it in the future, just park it, essentially. So she had to obviously pause her career. But she was so, like, resourceful. Like, she did so much, you know, she'd take us to school, pick us up, and then... You know, during the day while we were at school, she'd be doing lots of various jobs. You know, she was like she was a school governor. She'd like work at the local nursery. Like, she had a caretaking job for older people. She volunteered at the local center, like helping to fill out forms for the Bangladeshi community who, you know, English wasn't their first language. So she was like so like well known within the community, and she did so much. But I obviously didn't realize as a child, like, how much she was doing until, you know, obviously in my adulthood, having had a child now, knowing that she did all of that, and she had myself and my brother. And I just, I'm just in complete awe, like, how she managed to do all of that. And sometimes, as you say, like, I have those like feelings of guilt that sort of surface, and I'm like, why am I complaining? Like, I don't have any of that challenge. I have a supportive husband. Like, I have that freedom of choice, as you say, like, economically as well, we have that independence. You know, you and I both work, for example. It's like, so much has changed, right? And we're able to, you know, if you want to, like, further our careers, obviously it's quite still quite a challenge, you know, when you want to balance, like, having a child with wanting to still, like, develop your career. And there's always that that balancing exercise and that guilt either way. So if you're like spending time with your child, you're like, oh gosh, you know, I should be replying to that email or in the office. You're like, oh, I really should be with my son now. He's not feeling very well. That kind of constant guilt that just never goes away.
For sure. Mom guilt has been a massive thing I've struggled with a lot, and I still do struggle with. And
how would you say, like your relationship with your mum has, would you say it's changed since you had a child, or would you say it's like evolved in like a good way, or has it
God, it's just like completely added a huge shift of perspective onto it. And like you say, you know, when you reflect on what they achieved and what they did while also raising young kids. I've asked my mom quite a lot of questions, actually.
Like,
you know, just trying to understand it a bit more, to be honest, what her experiences actually were when I was a similar age to my daughter, and just asking her, because she had to work full time. My mom and dad at the time, they were living in London and they were struggling financially quite a lot. And, you know, my mom had to go to work quite early on. I think she said after 6 months, she left me with a nanny at home, you know.
Yeah.
So she after 6 months after giving birth, living alone in London and all of that. So,
oh, goodness. Yeah.
It's just really intense.
Like, so different. I mean, it's so different. Yeah.
I mean, it's really hard to hear it, like I said, like you were saying, without feeling so like ungrateful for what I've got.
Literally, but, so ungrateful.
I'm just like hearing it, I'm like, wow, I literally have everything and she suffered so much. But yeah, I mean, it's changed our relationship so much. It's brought us a lot closer together.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah.
And I'm trying to, I don't know how it's kind of working. It's not working very well, but I'm kind of trying to encourage her to look after herself more. And, you know, like I was saying before about we can put ourselves first and we don't have to put ourselves last, and trying to impart that onto her and say, you know, you don't have to like do everything for everyone now. Yeah, like, you can.
Yeah.
And just understanding, you know, what even is rest? Like, what is rest to us individually? Mm-hmm. What does it actually mean to rest? And what does it mean to, you know, fill your cup, have a healthy practice in life, do things that bring you joy, you know, spend time doing things that bring you joy. I see more and more, I mean, I don't know how it is generally outside the South Asian community, but I see it with my own like kind of grandparents and things. Just the amount of, you know, pressure they had to work, and financially the health has completely deteriorated, and living like healthy later lives. So
yes,
the time, because we don't know how to look after ourselves necessarily, we don't know how to put ourselves first, our health is impacted, and then also we just kind of end up watching TV or like doing really like unhealthy things,
sedentary things.
And just not really finding out what's truly kind of good for us, in a sense. So I took my mom for the first time to like a full-on spa day a couple of weeks ago. You know, she's never been before because obviously it's quite expensive. She's never been able to like afford it properly. I just took her for the first time for her birthday, and it was just so nice to actually see her getting pampered, you know, getting treated. And like, she just sat, lay down in the sauna and was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And I was like, yay. I'm not saying you have to like burn money and you don't have to always do these kind of very expensive things, I suppose. But I guess what I'm trying to say is it's about exploring that for yourself and thinking, how can I really rest like on a daily basis? How can I really look after myself and stuff? So I'm trying to encourage her to do that. And I think that's what I've learned from motherhood, and that's what really helps me to counteract the mum guilt is just reflecting on it and saying, actually, this mum guilt is not, where is it coming from? It's actually coming from the expectation that I should be doing everything. It's coming from the expectation that I shouldn't be putting myself first. It's coming from those kind of unconscious ideas that as women we put everyone before ourselves, put everyone's needs first but our own, and we're serving everyone else but ourselves. So it's just trying to deprogram yourself mentally from that,
unlearning all of those societal expectations.
And I saw my mum do that, and I saw my mum be praised for that. I've seen so many women in my family and generally be praised for serving others, you know, putting themselves last. And I remember speaking to a really amazing, you know, woman about it. And she was like, why do we praise Indian women or, you know, South Asian women that kill their own souls?
Yeah.
Like, why do we put that on a pedestal? Why do we say, well done, you've completely like destroyed who you are?
Yeah, completely. What, no sense of identity.
Here's a medal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, here's a great medal for it, you know? So that really hit home. And then I was on a podcast recently with entry-level mums. They're amazing as well.
Yeah, I saw that. That looked amazing. Great. It was hilarious.
Oh, so good. It was so fun. And yeah, one of them was like, the way that they got rid of mum guilt was that they realized what happens when they don't look after themselves.
And it's not good for your child. Like, if you're...
No,
if you're
she got best. Into like, you know, really bad, you know, depression and anxiety and all of these things. And so I just try and remember that. I'm like, what happens when I don't ask someone else to look after my child?
Mm-hmm.
What happens? And what happens is not good. So, you know, yeah, these are the things that have kind of helped. But it is a lot of that, like you said, unlearning, reparenting yourself.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God, yeah. Holy shit. Like, all of this stuff about gentle parenting now and like conscious parenting is a complete shift from growing up with a very authoritarian style of parenting. Mm-hmm. My mom did loads of, she was never, you know, very aggressive, but there was definitely a fear-based approach to being like
disciplining
back
and
back to my authority, you know?
Yeah.
A lot of fear-based kind of thing. And I always remember her being quite like, you know, very happy and very fun. And then it would be like, oh, like ice cold kind of, you know, Elsa frozen land if we overstepped anything.
Yeah.
And there was never any talk about emotions. That's like a big thing now. There was never anything of like, oh, you're feeling angry, validating emotions. And holy crap, like it's so different. And
so different.
I just remember like being told, stop crying, you know. Okay, she would comfort me, but then she'd be like, bus, stop
crying. Get over it now. Yeah, you've had your cry.
Yeah, like, stop crying. Like, okay, yeah. stop crying. Like, you know, it would get to that point. So different now. Now it's, I'm trying to be more like validating my daughter's emotions and breathing and understanding my own emotions. Like, I literally have no idea how to process anger. I've realized that. I'm just like,
I really struggle. Emotion? Yeah, I really struggle with processing anger as well. And I think part of it is also stems from childhood, like observing other people, like in my family, like my dad was, you know, a very angry person. So, you know, he had a very short fuse, and I observed like how he behaved, right? And I do think that some of it, to an extent, obviously it's like innate. You behave how you behave, you have a personality, right? But then also some of it is learned behavior. So it's like, how do we untangle those things, right? And how do we control ourselves better? Like, I do find that. And I think having a you know, a young child has really opened up that can of worms, because I never really thought of it that way. And now I feel like I've got to be very conscious, because he's
Yeah, 100%. They literally see everything. And I've actually really benefited from therapy. I know it's quite like a trendy thing to say now, but literally I know literally everyone's doing therapy, but you know, with this kind of annoying, I guess, aspect of privilege, the privilege side of things where we're talking about, you know, we do have I do have resources to kind of afford therapy, which is great. And like, you know, what are you actually spending your money on? Are you spending it on a new designer bag or new whatever, or actually spending it on therapy? I'd rather spend it on therapy, to be honest. And it's just been a really amazing resource, the South Asian therapists, you know, website and directory. And I've actually found like a South Asian female Punjabi therapist, and she's been incredible and amazing. And she's not had kids or anything, but she has really, really helped me navigate this whole change in my life. And I really feel like therapy should be offered to like every new mum.
Everyone, yeah.
Honestly, especially, definitely, just especially new mums. And because 99% of, you know, all these things, like you're saying, it stems from your own childhood, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like therapy can help you to unpack that and like reflect on that. And how are you taking, like, I mean, full circle, just talking about forward culture, how are you shedding those things that no longer are serving, and how are you like reinventing certain things? How are you introducing new things as well? So I think that's been a huge help. So shout out to South Asian Therapists Directory for that. It's been great. It's been really, really helpful.
That sounds like an amazing resource, and thanks for flagging that. Actually, I might look it up after chatting today. That sounds really, really helpful. I think we already touched upon this, like my next sort of discussion point was going to be around navigating loss of identity, learning to find ourselves again. But I think we've already touched upon this quite a lot. So I think one thing to, you know, help, you know, navigate and find ourselves again is shedding that mum guilt, right? And doing things for ourselves. I think those are two very necessary steps to take in order to find that sense of identity and belonging, and like, just being your whole self again,
I was just reflecting yesterday. I was doing some paint by numbers, which is really sad. I don't know why I find it so sad. I literally posted on Instagram and I was just like, is it sad and basic to do paint by numbers? Is it also helping my mental health? Yes.
Yeah.
But rather than scrolling on a screen while before bedtime. No, reading a book, it just seems really mentally like, and taking a lot of energy to read a book. I just was doing a bit of painting, like paint my numbers. And I just like thought to myself, I was like, what if I saw my mum thriving? Like how would I feel as a young girl if I saw my mum doing things that she genuinely like enjoyed, not for other people, but for herself.
Yeah.
And I was just reflecting, like, how would that make me feel as a young kid? And it would just like bring me so much joy. Cause I remember like as a kid, I used to say to my mom, like, mommy, like, be happy. And I used to say to her, be happy. And she used to say, like, mommy can't be happy all the time. And so that, I just reflecting on that, and you just think, that's what your kid wants, isn't it? Like, when you're happy, your kid gets so much joy seeing you happy.
Yeah. It's a mirror, isn't it? They reflect. Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm not saying you should be happy all the time, but I'm just saying, you know, imagine what a feeling it gives your children to see you thriving, to see you achieving what you want to achieve and, you know, living your best life, essentially. What joy that will bring them. I don't think they'd be mad about it. They wouldn't be like, oh my God, that's so annoying.
That's the other side of the coin, isn't it? Are they going to be like, oh, well, you've neglected me, like you've prioritized
me? I do get worried about that. And yeah, I've tried to unpack that a bit in therapy, because I do get really paranoid about my child feeling neglected or abandonment. Because my own father left when I was like six. So I have this kind of, I think I do have this thing about, I just don't want her to feel like, you know, abandoned, essentially. So, but then my therapist got me to write a list of describing my childhood, and then right next to it, write a list describing Ruhi's childhood, my daughter's childhood. And she like made me look at that and be like, look how different it is.
How different.
Like, it's literally completely different. You know, the kind of, you know, relationships that my daughter has, and that stability and that security and that regularity and that communication and everything, like, look all that she has, like, you know. So she kind of made me just see that kind of that it's not the same. So I think it's a really good exercise to just compare and really write out, like, what is your child's experience and how you know, what kind of security do they have? They have so much security. So it's been
that is such an interesting exercise. And I imagine, like, if you do it over time as well, like as she gets older, she starts school and she becomes a teenager, and you'd be able to see like what your experience was like in those phases of life and versus hers, like that'd be so eye-opening.
Massively. And how you should be conscious not to project your experiences onto your child, because they are in a completely different context. So
yes,
you know, don't project your kind of like fears onto your child necessarily. Keep it kind of relevant to what they're experiencing.
Exactly. You don't want to pass on those like anxieties or fears onto them,
right? It's
easier said than done, though, isn't it? I mean, there are
hell, I'm probably gonna mess her up somehow.
There'll be something.
She's probably like, gonna go to therapy about me some way or shape or form.
I think, and as I think we've touched upon this, both of us have, you know, being honest and frank about how we're feeling and nurturing that kind of same safe space for our children as well is really important. And I think, as you say, like examples of like gentle parenting, talking about feelings, those are things like I don't remember in my childhood ever doing. And I don't think, I'm not blaming my parents, you know, they were very busy, they had so many things going on, they wouldn't even have time to like reflect on what was going on, even for themselves, really, let alone me. But yeah, it is such a privilege to be able to do something like that, right? To have the space and the time and the sort of mental capacity, the bandwidth, really, to be able to do that with your children.
And I think they just didn't have the language, you know.
Maybe
if they picked up a book or something like that, but because of the internet, like you're saying, there's so many, it's like a double-edged sword, you know. The kind of stuff I found on Instagram has been so amazing. Honestly, I've learned so much.
And not so just reassuring.
Not just on like a surface level, like a deeper level.
Mm.
It's given me the language and the tools, and literally sometimes I just use scripts that I've like saved posts on Instagram of like, okay, this is how I can kind of articulate the emotions, and like, you know, I can see that you're angry or whatever, you know, these kind of things.
Yeah.
And it sounds really awkward when I say it, but at least I've got those kind of tools in my in my toolbox to try and experiment with and try and use. And it is a minefield. Like, I love and hate social media both equal measure.
Love hate relationship.
But it's I've got to say, like, if you do navigate it well, you can find some really amazing resources that can help you. And like I said, I just don't think my parents had the language and
all the
like you're saying, the bandwidth and because they were so stressed out with work and everything, you know, you just don't have the patience. Trying to provide
financially, yeah.
No, you just don't have the patience. You just don't have the time and things like that. So I totally agree. But I do feel like I try and curate my feed on Instagram as much as I can so that I'm getting stuff that's really helping me, like, navigate parenthood. And I found this page the other day and I just unfollowed it yesterday, I think, because too much, like, because you've got to be careful of like these posts saying you should be doing this, you should be doing that, like, you know, like trying to make you feel guilty and stuff like that. So I think it's really useful, but it's also totally you can
be toxic. Sometimes you definitely confusing. Have like, you know, feel inadequate, right, when you see stuff. Or yeah, there's definitely some aspects of that which, yeah, as you say, you need to be careful of. But yeah, I mean, you know, setting good examples for our children, like, what are some of the lessons that you've learned that you would want to pass on, right, in your childhood, like seeing your parent and parents, or seeing like other members in your family, like parent or friends even, like, is there anything you want to, you know, instill or want to follow as a good example that you want, you know, Ruhi to be able to, you know, lead or consider?
I've been struggling with something recently, and I'm still trying to unpick it a bit. It's just this whole thing about respecting elders. And especially, you know, in South Asian culture.
That old chestnut.
It's a real tricky one, because we, you know, we're talking about conscious parenting and articulating your emotions and validating emotions and, like, you know, allowing them to express themselves. And this whole thing of authoritarian parenting plays into it as well, because essentially authoritarian parenting is more like, I am the adult, I am the boss, you do as I say. And that is quite similar to how we relate to elders in our community. Like, even if an older South Asian person would say to me something I don't agree with or something disrespectful, I would never dare to say anything back. I'd just like fester in my own life. Yeah. And then I'd go to like a Forward Culture kind of event and be like, mean something to me, you know, like, I just try and vent it out somewhere. I'd never say it to their face, because it's that aspect of like respect. I'm still grappling with it, and I like you said, how do we model these aspects? Because this is the number one thing I've learned in parenting, is like, they generally will do as you do, not as you say. Can if you want to teach your kids something, like, how are you actually practicing that thing ultimately? That's what the first thing you've got to ask yourself. So for 100%. Me is like, I'm living with my in-laws as well. It's like, how do I practice that on a daily basis? I'm sure she obviously sees me treat them with respect and things like that, treating everyone with respect. But the other side of that is, how do I show her how to really articulate her emotions, articulate her opinions, feel like she can express herself and be heard and not just have to be a good little girl? But do that in a respectful way. That is something.
Her, right, to speak out.
Because I don't want her to like just not say things and like just pretend to try and, you know, be good.
Mm. I mean, there's an element of being submissive, and because she's a girl, right, as well. So there's that aspect. But yeah, the respecting the elders. It's because there isn't a level playing field, right? There's an imbalance of power, right? So it's like the default. If you're older, you have more power. You know, what you say is more valid than someone who's younger than you because they don't have as much experience. That's like my understanding is that is the basis for why they feel like they deserve more respect, right? Or if they're in a room with younger people, they're the ones who get the final say, or, you know, need to have that level of respect. But then, you know, obviously in Western culture, it's very different, right? It's not about your age, right?
I just remember these like comedy sketches where I think it was Russell Peters who was like doing comedy.
Oh yeah, he's so funny. Yeah,
is like a white kid, and his dad and me like, "F you, dad." It's like, I'm not Ryan's mom. All of that. So yeah, I think yeah, there's definitely this thing about respecting elders in South Asian culture that we grapple with, and how do we express ourselves and express our opinions and ideas in a respectful way. I think we do that with what she sees on a daily basis. But, you know, sometimes I've had to even gather myself, and I'm hoping that she can see me do this. And it's really hard for me. But once someone, like an older South Asian person in my family, commented on my weight after having a kid, and was like, "Oh, you put on a bit of weight," or something, or,
God,
this was Andrew. He was quite young, so she wouldn't have understood what I was doing. I think she was only like months or something, and I had to take a breather. I kind of said, "Oh, it doesn't matter." I took a breather, and then I came back, and in front of everyone else in the family, I just said, "You know, when you said that to me, that's actually something really insensitive, like the amount." Yeah. And I just went on this big lecture. I didn't say it in a I don't think I said it in a disrespectful way, because there was elders in the room.
So you said it like factually, like this is how you're making
I said it very factually, and I was getting quite emotional, but I literally said, "I don't want my daughter to be around these kind of comments." Like, I don't want her to, you know, have these toxic ideas of a body image. I tried to say it in a way that they would understand, basically, of like how effed up saying stuff like that is. But I did validate and say that in Punjabi culture, and a lot of Asian cultures as well, it's very common as the casual thing to say about commenting on people's weight, commenting on people's skin color, commenting on acne or whatever. Body appearance is very casually,
it's just a hyper focus on like floors, right? Or whatever they're thinking on the floor. They're like, "Oh, we've got this," or, you know, my mom does it all the time, or she, you know, like if I've got a spot.
Yeah, and I did validate that. I did say I understand that it's used in a lighthearted way.
Yeah.
But it actually really hurts my feelings, and it really makes me feel conscious. And no one likes to be criticized. No one likes having their kind of insecurities highlighted. I've just had a baby. I've just given birth to a human being. You know, I don't think it's really important for you to comment on that way.
Yeah, just have a bit more like compassion and
and have a bit more sensitivity. And I just kind of, you know, so I hope she can see me do more things like articulate, especially when it comes to certain things. Like, some things you just gotta let go, like they're never gonna change, like whatever, you know, because they're older, you know. Some things you just gotta fight, you gotta pick your battles. Some things you can't let it fly. Like, if anyone commented on like skin color or,
oh my gosh,
like a body image or anything like that, I would just pull rank, like not pull rank, but I would just literally pull it out and just be like, "I'm sorry, but I have to disagree." You know, like, try and do it. Yeah, but try and do it in a respectful way, I guess. Yeah. So, yeah, I hope she sees me do that. I hope she's able to do that herself in a better way than I was able to. So, yeah, that's one thing I really hope I can pass on. It's really difficult. How to stand up for yourself in a way that's going to have the most impact, and not be hurtful. Too hurtful.
Yeah. that's really good. I'm gonna completely agree with you. And
yeah,
obviously, like, some aspects are gendered. Like, I've got a son, things are different. My focus is gonna be, you know, how he treats women, right, as he grows up. Like, what is his relationship with women? Like, what, how does he treat them? What has he grown up seeing? Like, you know, and part of that is to do with how you see your parents interact, right? How does he see, like, as he grows up, like, how does he see that my husband, you know, his dad treats me?
Yeah, that's a massive thing. Yeah.
Yeah, because I've seen my brother, like, how he behaves. Like, he, you know, sometimes struggles with controlling his anger. And I do think some of it's, you know, learned from when he used to see my parents when we were kids interact, right? So, and he's been quite open about it and said, you know, I do think, like, some of this is, you know, stuff that I picked up as a kid, and, you know, acknowledging it and saying, you know, I need to, you know, be more cautious, or just a bit more self-aware, I guess. There is a lot to you know, the positive stuff that you can take away, because there would have been things, you know, in both of our childhoods, no doubt, like, that were really, like, lovely, like, lovely memories that you want to, you know, recreate with your own children. So yeah, thinking about, you know, enjoying and thriving in motherhood, I think we have briefly touched upon this. We've spoken about quite a lot of the sort of reality checks around it, but also, like, some of the lovely things of, you know, being able to, I guess, I know this sounds really cliche, but, like, seeing the world through their eyes, like, seeing them experience things that you know, remember experiencing as a child yourself. And I think some of this is probably yet to come for both of us, but
yeah.
Like, even, like, the other day when we took him to, like, feed the ducks, like, it was just so nice, like, seeing his eyes light up, like, in the lake, like, watching the ducks. And it's just so novel for him, right? Obviously for us it's, like, you know, a standard thing to be doing, but yeah, it was just really, really nice to make memories like that, I'd say.
I think when it comes to thriving and not just surviving in motherhood, it's still something I'm trying to figure out. I think generally everyone said that 0 to 5 years is, like,
it's fucked.
It's the pits. Yeah, it's pretty deep. It's pretty down there. So I think I'm just slightly reassured by that information okay.
I've heard the same.
You know, it's going to get better, apparently, until the teenage years, and that's also the pits. But at least we'll be sleeping then, hopefully.
Yeah, because people always say that, oh, you know, this lack of sleep isn't permanent. But then when you're in it, you're like, oh my God, I literally just want to sleep. It's so hard.
Really,
like,
just want to sleep. Like, that is, like, the number one priority.
And I hate when people are like, oh, mine just slept through the night from, like, 6 weeks old. I'm like, good for you. That's great.
Yeah. I'm like, I never want to see you again in my life. So I think it's just being reassured, by that kind of long term view of things and being like, you know what, it's not going to be like this forever. We just got to get through these tough bits, and just trying to keep that bigger picture in mind. That really helps me not
I agree,
overwhelmed with the
grueling
aspects of it. But
and solidarity,
massively solidarity, speaking to other like-minded kind of moms, that's been a huge help. Just sending each other memes at night of suffering in motherhood, that
all the time. I do it so much with my sister-in-law, my husband's sister. She's got 3 kids, and she's obviously, the kids are a lot older at school now, but she sends me a lot of relatable mum content all the time, and that's literally how we communicate now. So, and it's great. I love it.
So I agree with that side of it, you know, just surviving, and I mean, the solidarity, and also just trying to find the kind of lightheartedness in it, not taking things too seriously, not taking things too personally. Like, if your kid is literally like going, or like whatever, I don't know, in the future, she might be like, I hate you. I'd be like, yeah, you have an underdeveloped brain, so you probably don't know what you're talking about. Like,
yeah, it's so hard not to take things personally when you, like, sometimes when my son wants to, like, spend, you know, like, sometimes he has a preference, right? He'll want to play with his dad, and I'll find it so offensive. I'm like, oh my gosh, like, I've literally given birth to you. You don't want to spend time. You can't help it sometimes, but you just have to, I guess, take a step back. And as you say, look at the bigger picture. This is not going to be forever. Their brain isn't properly developed.
Really try and keep that bigger perspective in mind. It's a huge thing. And just try and get your breaks, try and get your little moments of peace, little moments of rejuvenation and breathes. I know they're kind of few and far between in the early days, but just try and keep them there, try and keep those regular breaks in place, and that mom guilt, you know, shedding that mom guilt will help you to do that. Try and get other people to look after your kid, try and like carve out that time for you and really fill it with things that are gonna help you to stay buoyant, really. That's what I would kind of say, and just put yourself first.
That's a really good point to remind ourselves of, and we've spoken about this a couple of times now in this session, but I think it's really good to pick up on that and remind ourselves. And it's just like, it becomes a mantra, right, for yourself personally. Like, put, you know, think about yourself, do something for yourself, because if you don't, you know, think about it, then you're not going to do it, are you? So
it's like really reprogramming a lot especially like we're saying, from a South Asian female perspective, it's just really, you're having to kind of make that effort to reprogram. But then how is that going to impact the next generations? You know, it can hopefully be in a positive way. So
hopefully. And then I wanted to finish on a broader note, really, about forward culture. Obviously got lots of things, you know, in the pipeline, but I mean, what are your sort of future plans or initiatives, or any events that we should know about, the listeners should know about? Please tell us.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I mean, you can just stay updated with us via our website. So forwardculture.co, our newsletter is the best place you can find updates. Obviously, Instagram is there, but it's a lot of stuff on Instagram. Like, you might not see our posts, I guess. But just check us out online on our website, and stay updated via our newsletter. What we've got coming up, we are planning to have an open mentoring program round. So that means that it's not just specifically with schools. We're planning to just open it up online. So anyone who would like to have a South Asian female mentor, we have over 200 mentors signed up now. So women from 100 different kind of industries. Then we've got doctors, we've got lawyers, but then we've got artists, dancers, creatives, we've got people in media. All these women have kind of offered to be potential mentors to people who'd like to kind of go through our program. So we're hoping to open that up towards the end of this year, and then we have a training program, so the mentors will be trained, and the whole program is quite structured, so you'll have support along a kind of 6-month process. And then, we've got some events coming up later on this year in Leicester, hopefully. So we're just shaping those up. We're working with local organisations here in Leicester to deliver those. And then London, I think we're hoping to do more next year in London. So we're thinking about having kind of speed mentoring events.
Like speed dating, but mentoring.
Short kind of mentoring sessions. And then people can kind of rotate and just mingle. And
that sounds amazing.
About different careers and industries and experiences. So that's what we're thinking of trialing. Other than that, we have a lot of kind of stuff that we put out online and content. And like I said, our focus group is something we're really developing at the moment. So please do DM us. We've got a post on Instagram about it. If you'd like to be part of a kind of focus group that helps us to shape what we do. So we're developing both an advisory board and a focus group. So we've got trying to get regular input into what we do, so that we make sure, like I said, we're always staying relevant and staying purposeful what we do, and just building those kind of networks and communities into South Asian female space. So we're trying to grow it slowly. And we're always kind of looking out for people to join our team. We've got two amazing people at the moment with us who are helping deliver what we do. But we are hoping to grow the team as well, and, you know, looking for volunteers and things as well. So, just get in touch with us anytime. And similarly, like, if you have a school or college or know a university that would benefit from working with us with the mentoring program and partnering brown female kind of in different careers with younger students and things, like, just let us know. Like, we can work with organizations and institutions as well for our mentoring program. So we're looking for those partners as well.
Sounds amazing. You and your co-founder, like, what absolute powerhouses.
Both mums now as well. Both of us have got little
What a journey to be going on at the same time together
as well. It's been a bit of a blip. Like, we've had, over COVID, we both had kids and things, and we're just kind of coming out, I think. So we're, you know, kicking off with a round of mentoring. And then I think now over the next few years, we're really finding our feet again after COVID and kids.
So. Yeah. All sounds super exciting. And just on the mentoring, so if anyone who is still interested in either becoming a mentee or a mentor, is the sort of round still open?
We're opening up later on this year. Yeah. Okay. So it's not open yet, just yet. But if you kind of subscribe to our newsletter on our website, forwardculture.co, then you'll get an update on when the round opens.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. That's great. Really helpful. And yeah, hopefully listeners take away something from it. And if they aren't already following, give Forward Culture a follow so you can hear all the latest updates. Well, thank you so much for giving up your time today, Seethal. It's been nice talking to you, and quite cathartic actually, in a way, talking about our various experiences in motherhood and just navigating everything in life. So I just wanted to say
it really especially as brown women, like, you've got a whole added layer of stuff you have to deal with, so it's so much
to unpack, so many layered experiences, right?
100%.
But yeah, thank you, and I really hope you enjoyed talking as well.
I did. Thank you so much for having me, and yeah, I'll keep track of the future episodes. Thank you so much for doing this.
You're very welcome.
Thank you so much for listening to Brown Don't Frown podcast. If you know someone who you think might like this episode, please do let them know about it. If you enjoyed this podcast, please do leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. And make sure you hit the subscribe button and you'll be notified as soon as a new episode goes out. Producing and hosting this podcast is done by me on an entirely voluntary basis. So if you do enjoy listening, please consider supporting it through Patreon so that it can continue to provide you with engaging and meaningful content. If you would like to donate, you can do so by heading over to patreon.com/browndontfrownpod. If you have any thoughts or comments or would like to get in touch and contribute to the podcast, do drop us a line at browndontfrownpod@gmail.com. We hope you enjoyed listening.